Hello, welcome to the Livestreams Carawarra podcast. We're delighted to have you join us. We invite you to sit back, relax, and listen to our latest episode. Thanks for joining.
So, when I was thinking about what to speak about today, I went through the topics. I was looking at the scriptures that I was going to be talking about today, and I realized there was an interesting theme between all of them. I think that there is something afoot in our world at the moment that is a very pressing concern for many people, and that is the subject of miracles. It's the subject of things unexpected and things of a supernatural or godly nature. And this is a question that can be looked at in many, many different ways, and I'm sure a lot of you in your own lives have thought about this in different ways. So I'll ask a question, and of course, you don't have to answer if you don't feel comfortable, but as a show of hands, who here in this room believes that at some point in your life you've experienced or witnessed a miracle? Oh, that's most of you. Fantastic. Praise God. That's excellent. And I would be willing to guess that those of you who haven't probably know someone who would claim that they have. It turns out this is fairly consistent with what we read. In fact, today there are literally hundreds of millions of people who claim to have experienced a miracle, which is quite remarkable. So, before getting into the scriptures that we're going to look at today, I think there's a proverb that seems quite appropriate. A discerning person keeps wisdom in view, but a fool's eyes wander to the ends of the earth. Maybe the full meaning of that will become more apparent as we go on. So we're going to be looking today at Luke 8, 22 to 50, which is a collection of very interesting stories about Jesus. So the first of these is the storm. So I'll just read out the scriptures and then we can hear about them afterwards. So one day, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go to the other side of the lake." So they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake, so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are going to drown." He got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided, and all was calm. "Where is your faith?" he asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him." This is a fairly unusual event. I think it's fair to say that's the kind of thing that you wouldn't see particularly often, a gigantic storm being calmed, especially when you're in the midst of it. So we go on. The healing of a demon-possessed man. They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the Lake of Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but he had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged him repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into them, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw that this had happened, they ran off and reported this to the town and the countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. So this is another remarkable situation. I don't know how many of you will have attended or worked at a healing ministry of any kind, but I had the privilege of attending a place like that for quite a while. And it was a fascinating thing seeing people who are afflicted by demons. And it was even more incredible seeing what God can do with those people even today. That's something I can attest to. I've seen many, many, many situations like that, and it is remarkable. So now we come to another interesting story. And this one's kind of in two parts. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a ruler of the synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come out of his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding was stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know the power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Do not be afraid, just believe. She will be healed." When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told her to give her something to eat. Told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Three absolutely incredible stories, and three things that I would say it's probably fair to say a lot of us haven't seen firsthand, even if we have seen miracles. People being raised from the dead, casting out demons, that is something that we see more often, and the calming of storm. Now, the remarkable thing about these stories is that despite the absolutely incredible nature of them, these are things that were attested, and they are things that have continued to be attested in various forms throughout history. And for most of human history, that was absolutely sufficient. People believed this. It was widely just accepted. A God exists, and that God heals. Even people of other cultures and beliefs all had no trouble believing that there was a God and that God healed, or various gods who healed in different ways. It wasn't until sort of about 300 years ago or so that something dramatic changed in the world, and this was the Enlightenment. Now, the Enlightenment is a time that I'd say for most of us growing up, we've probably heard that this was an incredible time for human progress. The world came out of the Dark Ages with their, you know, pre-Enlightenment mythologies and beliefs about God, and embraced a wiser, more intellectually honest form of belief, which is a belief in science and progress and human value at the expense of those things that the people from yesterday believed in. Now, a lot of people grew up in this day and age never hearing another story. They don't hear that there is a God who heals. They don't hear that incredible things happen in the world. They just hear the Enlightenment narrative. Now, I'm not an opponent of the Enlightenment in one sense. I believe that incredible things did come from it. But you have to understand that the Enlightenment is not a process that happened in isolation. It was built on the back of an extremely long and extremely committed Christian tradition. And it's one of the reasons why no thing like that has ever happened in any other culture. It is a unique phenomena in the West. There was an ecclesiastical tradition of scholarship that went back almost 1,000 years before the Enlightenment actually happened, where science, medicine, philosophy, And all of these subjects that we basically have today were already being investigated, astronomy, chemistry, and they have developed over time, absolutely. But again, a lot of things changed in the Enlightenment when people started to put this greater emphasis on human insight. And this is where I come again back to that proverb. There is something in us that seeks answers, and I believe that God put that in us. But that is an instinct that can very easily become unbalanced when we believe that we alone are capable of finding the truth. When we put our mind on a pedestal and say, I can find the answer, and it doesn't matter who tries to stop me or what else there is out there, I will find it for myself. That is one of the things that happened in the Enlightenment. And there really is no better example of this than the philosopher David Hume. So David Hume was a Scottish philosopher. He lived sort of in the late 1600s and early 1700s. And he had he's one of the sort of early people to discredit the idea of miracles in the modern world. So as he says, no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which endeavors to establish. So Hume looked at the world and he saw these accounts of the miraculous, and being an Enlightenment man, he had adopted a view which was that for science, well, for the world to be fundamentally understandable, you had to suspend things which we had no way of measuring. He set the hard limit at what can be empirically observed, which is one of the other products of the Enlightenment. There was a conflict between the rational thinkers who argued that sort of through our mental faculties we could reach beyond the realm of the empirical, and there were the empiricists who argued that no, we can't really know anything beyond that, and in fact it would be foolish to even try. So David Hume discredited the idea of miracles completely, and many people now take that assumption up without really ever having actually considered it. It's just something that's built into our collective conscience, you know. There are empirical facts and there are religious truths. That's the way that the dichotomy is usually expressed. You can believe what you want to believe. You can hold to your fantasies about God and the miraculous as your ancestors once did. But here in the 21st century, we care about science and progress. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. And I think one of the amazing things about the world that we live in today is more and more people are starting to recognize this. Not only because there's been a massive increase in interest in, you know, God and religion and the unity between that and science, but also because people are starting to see the limits of science. They're starting to see the limits of empiricism. One of the things about assuming that God doesn't exist is it means that we have no basis for our morality. Truth becomes completely subjective. If there's nothing out there that's telling us what the truth is, well, who's to say? My answer is as good as your answer. And we saw a very, very good example of that in the 20th century. In fact, we saw many examples of that in the 20th century. We saw the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. We saw Mao's China. We saw the terrible famines in Russia. And all of these ideologies were built around the idea that, well, there is no fundamental truth, so the most powerful person gets to decide what that is. They put their mind on a pedestal and said, I get to decide what reality is, and if you disagree with me, well, too bad. It's a terrible tragedy that all of this has happened. But one of the things I wanted to say on this topic, and I suppose this is more of an apologetic sermon, because there's a good chance that sometime in your lives, if you have experienced a miracle, and that is something you tell people about, someone's going to want to challenge you about it. They're going to say, well, are you really sure that you experienced a miracle? Couldn't it have been this? You know, the mind has a remarkable way of healing itself. You know, scientific studies show, you know, etc. I'm sure some of you have already had these conversations before. But there's a couple of things about this Humean idea that I think it's very, very important for you to know. So first of all is the dichotomy between science and religious truth. So generally speaking, the scientific model postulates that for something to be empirically provable, it has to be repeatable under very specific conditions and return the same result every time. Now, there are certain things in our universe which this can technically apply for. But the interesting thing about that fact is you generally take it on faith that that has been accurately demonstrated. Most of us in this room are not scientists in every possible discipline on earth. And in fact, there's been a massive controversy in the scientific world that a lot of people actually don't know anything about, which is the replicatability crisis. So scientists have started to find that a huge amount of scientific studies that have been published in top journals around the world are actually not repeatable at all. There was a recent study that showed in the field of psychology about, well, less than 50% of what had been published in scientific journals could actually be repeated under the same conditions. An earlier study had showed that it was less than 40%. So there is a general assumption that people make when they choose to trust science. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't trust it. There are certain things in life where it is appropriate, but I'm saying do not assume that your trust is in something objective. You're taking a step of faith when you make that decision. You're taking a step of faith every time you make a decision to believe something. One of the things about Hume's argument is that the miraculous is something that, well, if it can't be repeated, then there's no validity to it. Now, obviously, this makes a massive assumption about God, which is that he is going to repeat himself in the same way multiple times every time. Well, there's no reason why that has to be true necessarily. In fact, by its very nature, the miraculous is something that we believe only happens once. It is an outlying situation. It's not one that's fundamentally repeatable. So if someone is miraculously healed, for example, well, that can be a one-off event. It's not something that a scientific study would necessarily be able to demonstrate. The other factor of that that's very important to remember is that we don't know how the physical and the metaphysical line up. God can work through the natural processes of our body. He can work through other agents in this world. I believe that God can work through doctors as much as that he can work through other things. And the other thing I think that's very important to consider as far as the philosophical side is concerned is that a lot of the time I've found when I talk to people about the miraculous, their problem is that they prayed for something and it didn't happen. And that I understand. That is an important question, but it's a very, very different question. When people say, I lost faith in God because there's so much suffering in the world, or I'm suffering and God didn't help me. So, well, that's terrible. It is terrible. Suffering is an awful thing a lot of the time. But just because there's suffering in the world doesn't mean that there's no God. Those two ideas don't stand in contradiction to one another. You could make the argument that there's an evil God, in fact. But I think that there's a much simpler explanation. The Bible talks about this all the time. There's nowhere in the Bible that says that life isn't going to be hard. In fact, if life weren't hard, what would your faith really be worth? How easy would it be to follow God if everything was just laid out before us? Well, that's what we think. But here in the West, when things have become easy, we've abandoned God. We don't need God anymore. We've got science. We have medicine. We have technology. We don't need to rely on God anymore. So this idea that God's existence and suffering stand in some sort of irrevocable relationship is a lie. It's one that people of the past didn't even have any trouble believing in. In fact, it's remarkable, actually, because I haven't really heard anyone arguing the non-existence of God based on the problem of suffering up until very, very recently. And I think it's because a lot of people in our society don't suffer the way that they used to. When all you knew was suffering from a very early age, well, you knew God in that world then, and you know God in the world as it is now. But a lot of people who are born into comfortable circumstances, it's just something that they take for granted. It's like, well, this doesn't look good. I don't want that. How could God possibly want that? So we can't conflate our understanding of the world and our present trials with God's non-existence. I believe very much that he is out there, that he cares about each and every one of us, and that he does want the best for us. But that doesn't mean that suffering is our enemy. And sometimes I truly, truly believe that we have to suffer in order to know God's love. It helps us to appreciate him. It helps us to rely on him. So if any of you are going through a situation where you're suffering and you're asking those difficult questions, rather than turning away from God and saying, where are you? I I'm going to look somewhere else. Pray to God and say, please be with me in this time. Please help me to know you more so that I can rely on you. Now, the interesting thing about miracles, aside from all of the different philosophical arguments that we could unpack, is the fact that it is something that is extremely widely attested, like I said. The interesting thing about scientific experiments is usually they only have to be replicated, you know, a few hundred times before they're actually considered a scientific test. Well, if human testimony is anything to go by, hundreds of millions of case studies that all say, I have experienced something of the supernatural, well, that is something that you can't easily sweep away. You could argue even that 1% of them were true, but that's still a million miracles, millions of miracles. In fact, if only one miracle ever actually happened, it would be enough to disprove that idea. One outlying case. And all of us here believe in the resurrection. Even if the only miracle God ever gave us was Jesus' death and resurrection, that would be enough. But thank the Lord that he has given us even more than that in his great mercy. So I encourage all of you, whatever situations you're in, and I recognize there can be extremely hard times in life. I've been through difficult times. I'm sure some of you have been through times much harder than the times that I've been through. But instead of asking God or thinking about the problem of you know, why there are not more miracles, ask God to give you what you need in that moment, because a miracle might not be the solution. Jesus recognized that while he was on earth. He looked around at the people. People asked him for the miraculous, and he said, "A wicked generation asks for a sign." And he wasn't saying that because he didn't love the people that he was ministering to. He just knew a miracle wouldn't convince them. I was watching a debate a little while ago between a chemist from Oxford University called Peter Atkins, who's an atheist, and a Canadian astrophysicist called Hugh Ross, who's a Christian. And they were debating about the question of God's existence. And at the end, the interviewer asked both of them, well, what would it take for you to change your perspective opinions on everything? And Hugh Ross, the Christian, said, well, if you could prove that any of what I believe is actually incorrect, then yes, that would deeply affect my faith. But Peter Atkins, the atheist, said, even if God himself came to me and presented himself before me, I wouldn't believe. I would believe I was insane before I would believe in God. The late Christopher Hitchens said exactly the same thing. If in my last days I start talking about God and saying God's revealed himself, assume I've gone mad. Jesus knew this better than anyone. He could discern what was in the hearts of those he was ministering to. I'm not saying this to discourage you for praying for miracles, because I know that it's good, and I know that God does deliver miracles. I can attest to stories in my own life where he has. But sometimes it isn't a miracle that we need, it's something else. And I think the goal of us as Christians is to discern and to ask God for what it is that we truly need when we're in need. To ask for faith, to ask for hope, to ask for something, but to want what God wants, not what we want. Because the second we privilege our own wants above God's, we become like the men of the Enlightenment. The people who believed that the ultimate pursuit was the pursuit of one's own understanding and happiness. But all of us, when we committed our lives to Christ, committed ourselves to serving under him, to wanting what he wanted. So I encourage all of you to take that out into your lives. And when you're asked questions about the miraculous, don't feel discouraged. There are miracles going on in the world, but even if they weren't, God is there with you, and he will give you what you need in those situations. I truly believe that, and I know that many of you in this room, based on the things that you've testified to, would believe that too. So I'll just pray as we conclude. Dear Lord, you are a good God. You are wonderful and gracious. And I know that you minister to us in our weakness. I pray, Lord, that you would give us humility, that you would give us the ability to want what you want and to desire what you desire, that you would give us the ability to ask and yet the ability to expect that whatever we're given in return will be perfect. I pray, Lord, that you would shower your gifts upon us and that you would anticipate our needs in every step of our lives. Please, Lord, bless every single person in this room and help them if they're struggling, if they're suffering. Give them faith, give them hope, and give them you in all of your abundance, so that no matter what happens in this physical world of ours, they would be comforted knowing that you are always with them. I pray all of this in your humble name. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed our latest episode. Tune in next week for another Life Streams Carawarra message. Have a blessed week.